Peace, beautiful people. Come journey with me around the world as I shine a light on stories about music, community, and resistance. This is Excursions with Gina Arias. On the eve of my mother's 75th birthday, my partner Fred Wunz and I traveled down to Florida for the festivities. I spoke with my mom about her life as she sat on the cusp of this milestone celebration. Born in the Dominican Republic in 1946, her childhood and early adolescence were spent living under the brutal dictatorship of Rafael Trujillo. As a young man, Trujillo spent 12 years in the Dominican National Guard and was trained by the U.S. Marines, which occupied the Dominican Republic from 1916 to 1924. He took power in 1930 under dubious elections, wherein all other candidates dropped out of the race, under constant harassment by the army. Almost immediately upon ascending to the presidency, he implemented martial law. He then made his political party the sole legal party. Any adult stopped by the police in the street without a membership card could be arrested for vagrancy. In 1936, Santo Domingo was renamed Ciudad Trujillo, Trujillo City, and a large electric sign simply stating God and Trujillo was erected. The highest mountain peak in the Dominican Republic and his home province, San Cristobal, were both renamed Trujillo. Besides narcissistic, Trujillo lived under the delusion of white supremacy. He was set to powder his face to try to appear lighter, and was vehemently anti-black and anti-Haitian. His barbarism in this regard culminated in October of 1937 with the massacre of approximately 35,000 Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent, primarily along the northwestern border dividing the two countries. Although my mother was quite young at the height of his violent reign, she recalled some aspects vividly.
Things that I remember, like when my parents used to listen to the radio station from out of the country, they were very quiet and they were in the bedroom and nobody knew that they were listening to something different than what the broadcast in the Dominican Republic were saying, because that was forbidden. So I would go and try to listen at the beginning, because I didn't know what they were listening to. And I was really screaming at and said, get out of here. This is not for you. And then later I learned that they were listening to things that against the dictatorship.
At the root of the anger expressed by my grandparents was undoubtedly fear. Understandable, since every institution was subjugated to Trujillo's power. Churches were made to post the slogan, God in heaven, Trujillo on earth, and even private homes were required to visibly demonstrate their allegiance.
My house had a picture of Trujillo. Everybody had to have it.
What did it say?
En esta casa, Trujillo es el jefe. In this house, Trujillo is the boss.
Anyone who dared to publicly oppose him was never to be heard from again, like Jesus de Galíndez, a Spaniard who had fled to the Dominican Republic in 1939, following the rise of Spanish dictator Francisco Franco. Galíndez became critical of Trujillo and fled to New York City for safety, where he wrote his doctoral thesis about Trujillo's vicious regime. Nevertheless, he could not escape Trujillo's reach.
You know where they got him?
Where?
At a subway. In Manhattan, he was teaching at Columbia University. He left his class and was going to take the subway home. And some people came, picked him up. There was an American pilot, and there were some Dominican people there, and they just picked him up like if they were the FBI or whatever. That's what they made pretend that they were some. They were picking him up from here. They put him on a plane and they brought him to the dictator Trujillo.
What happened after that is not known for certain, as his body was never found. but my mother repeated an often told version of the events that transpired next.
Oh, Trujillo made him eat the book that he wrote, because he wrote a book against the family, and he put the book in him and told him eat it and put it in his mouth, and then they brought the sharks and make him, the sharks eat him.
I grew up hearing this gruesome tale. Dissidents were often fed to sharks far from the coast in the deep sea, or murdered on quiet stretches of mountain roads, as the Mirabal sisters were in late 1960. But despite his bloodthirsty reign, not everyone was in opposition to it. This we learned when we sat down with Fred Juan's father, affectionately known as Big Freddy, when we traveled back to New York City to speak with him. Born the same year as my mother, he nevertheless had a very different experience at home with regard to the Trujillo regime.
Mi papá era trujillita. My father, he was a follower of Trujillo. So everybody had to be agreed with nothing against Trujillo.
It's hard to know whether people who supported him did so out of self-preservation or genuine respect. Although he violently stamped out opposition and ordered massacres, he also played the role of benevolent provider, which may have endeared him to some people.
And he used to bring things for the poor people, not that he was taking them out of poverty, but, you know, anyone who talked about Trujillo was, he was El Jefe, and, you know, you would talk to people and say, oh, they killed someone because said something bad about Trujillo. And these people would say, so why did he say something bad about Trujillo?
El Jefe, the boss. The United States government turned a blind eye to over three decades of totalitarian dictatorship led by El Jefe. Remember that all of this occurred in the midst of the Cold War, where the United States' focus was on destabilizing left-leaning and socialist movements and governments. But eventually, even the United States could not tolerate the Trujillo regime. One of the tipping points was Trujillo's attempt to assassinate the democratically elected president of Venezuela, Rómulo Betancourt. And so, the CIA provided material assistance for the assassination of Trujillo in 1961, as a U.S. congressional investigation revealed years later. He was shot to death on the road from the capital to San Cristobal, where he was going to see his lover, ambushed by brave patriots who had taken part with others in devising the bold plot. Big Freddy talked to us about the immediate post-Trujillo period.
When Trujillo was killed, everybody was like, everything ended after they killed Trujillo. It's like, this is going to be a disaster, right? So it gave us a feeling of a little bit of scare, and you don't know what was going to happen.
Uncertainty.
That basically what happened.
Uncertainty abounded across the Dominican Republic following the assassination, and my grandfather was swept up in the nation's crisis.
After they killed Trujillo, my father was put in jail for a few days because they were having masses for Trujillo in church, and everyone is supposed to cooperate, and my father didn't take his car and say, here is my car to bring people to the church to honor Trujillo.
When I asked my mom why my grandfather didn't cooperate, she had this to say.
Because he didn't want to, because he knew that this was stupid, because he wasn't there, his body wasn't there. They were just trying to show, you know, that people like him. And my father never liked Trujillo.
Following two general strikes calling for democratic elections, in December of 1962, the first free presidential election took place, and the people of the Dominican Republic elected by a landslide the wildly popular Juan Bosch, a leftist who had lived in exile for 23 years. Although he was still too young to vote, Big Freddy describes what he felt following the election of Bosch.
We were happy. I was happy. First of all, Juan Bosch has a style to talk to the people. He used to talk to the people in a manner so that people understand about everything. If he's going to talk about economy, he would give an example of something simple that the people could understand it. And everybody would listen to it on the radio, even though they don't have it in my house, well, everybody could listen to that. So we had a feeling that, feeling of freedom to begin with, to don't be afraid anymore.
Bush dove into his presidency with the development of a new constitution that granted new freedoms, including labor rights. The document provided novel protections for pregnant women, homeless people, children, including ones born out of wedlock, working class people, and farmers. One of his intentions was to break up latifundia, privately held plantation-sized farm estates, which concentrated wealth and land in the hands of a few to the detriment of the many. After just 7 months in office, however, Bosch was unseated by a coup led by Colonel Elias Wessing, who had helped Trujillo's family flee the country after he was assassinated. Bosch's government was replaced by a three-man military council, sending Bosch back into exile. A mere year and a half later, a second coup removed the military council from power, demanding the restoration of Juan Bosch. 4 days later, the United States government invaded the Dominican Republic. They sent 42,000 troops to occupy the country in support of the anti-Bosch forces. The U.S. did not want another Cuba in the Western Hemisphere, and left-leaning administrations, democratically elected or not, needed to be stamped out. The U.S. invasion sparked a dangerous period where civilians and organized rebel forces engaged in urban guerrilla warfare against the U.S. Marine troops on the streets of the capital, Santo Domingo. Families fled the violence to towns outside of the capital, including to my grandparents' home, as my mother recalled.
I remember my house being having refugees. Like, there were like two or three families at the time staying there because they couldn't go back to their house and the capital.
Friends?
Family and friends.
Because of the fighting?
Mm-hmm. Some houses were occupied, and some were occupied by the revolution, and some were occupied by the military.
The revolution that she is referring to were the various radical organizations that were standing up to the U.S. occupation and their interference in Dominican politics. These organizations included the MPD, the Dominican Popular Movement, which several of Fred One's family members were a part of, including his mother, Fabiola, who was deeply involved in the revolution.
Okay, when I met Fabiola, right, I get more exposed to the MPD, Movimiento Popular Dominicano, and that was a supposed to be a communist group.
What was their ideology?
They were Marxists. About politics, she always was involved about anything that had to do with the Communist Party, and I was happy to have been dating somebody that was that progressive, because she was very progressive. I don't know that, but I also think she was a member. The Federación Mujeres Dominicanas, FMD, the Federation of Dominican Women.
It was a time of fervent revolutionary principles that extended even to the realms of culture and music. Big Freddie remembers friends calling each other out on being influenced by American culture.
Today, the United States was penetrating in all ways, the Dominican Republic. In fact, they was giving like milk, cheese and cracker, whatever, through the United States. Some of the radical guys said that was a penetration. Also, remember, the American music, some of the radical guys didn't want to hear, listen to American music because that's a cultural penetration, which I don't know how deep that was.
I don't know. Was it? Did you like American music?
Oh, very much.
It penetrated.
I remember Chubby Checker.
Chubby Checker aside, the United States did eventually exert a strong pull on both my mother and Fred One's parents, who left the Dominican Republic and immigrated to New York, but for very different reasons and along varying paths. Even before graduating from college, my mother became employed as a teacher in one of the most prestigious private schools in the Dominican Republic. But in July 1970, she resigned from that position and came to New York City on her tourist visa, but with every intention to stay. Here, she wed her high school sweetheart, and in January of 1972, I was born from that short-lived marriage. In 1974, she returned to the Dominican Republic to apply for her green card in order to become a permanent U.S. resident, hedging her bets while back on the island in case her application was rejected. She applied for and landed a great job at the Dominican Telephone Company. Before she could even start in that role, she received a call from the U.S. Embassy. They questioned why she would want to immigrate to the United States.
You had a nice life here. You graduated college. You have a nice job. Why you want to leave? Because I want to go to the United States and have a different life. And, you know, somehow my vision was that there was not much advancement there for people if they were not in politics. Eventually, I probably would have gotten in politics. But to me, it was like it was a dead end because this was a country that wasn't developing the way it should be developing.
Her application was approved, and she returned to New York City to her job in a factory ironing ties in Queens. It may have been hard work, but her newfound sense of freedom was unparalleled. In DR, her home life was stifling. Despite being raised on an island, she never learned how to swim, as she and her sisters were sheltered, surveilled, and chaperoned to an oppressive level.
Oh, no. I didn't have any freedom. That's probably one of the reasons that made me move.
Both Big Freddie and Fabiola, on the other hand, had pressing life and death reasons to think about leaving for the United States. In 1967, Fabiola gave birth to her first son, Guido, whose father was also very involved in revolutionary politics, with a group that splintered from the MPD, known as the Proletariat Voice.
Guido's father, he was part of that group, and that group later on accused him of being a CIA agent. And then La Romana, when he went to see Guido, they kidnapped him and took him to the university and killed him. And it was a time that they were accusing Fabiola of being part of that. And she denied that. She suffered a lot. They went over after her. They put her in jail. There were a lot of things for that.
Guido's father, Caonabo Elpidio Jorge Tavares, a.k.a. Juanito el Lagarto, was more than just peripherally involved in the movement. In fact, he founded and served as the Secretary General of Proletariat Voice. Although we can't know for sure if he was a CIA agent, those who executed him and left his body in an abandoned home in the town of La Romana, not at the university as stated by Big Freddie, were clearly convinced of this. Undoubtedly, his murder was traumatizing for Fabiola, who was just 20 years old at the time. Violence within the revolutionary movement, particularly for people suspected of being CIA operatives, was all too real, as was the continued repression of and violence against dissidents by the reactionary conservative government of Joaquin Balaguer. Balaguer was elected president in 1966. No newcomer to politics, he had for decades served under Trujillo's tutelage in various administrative posts. Like Trujillo, he had little tolerance for political opponents or left-wing revolutionaries. It is estimated that in the first 12 years of his presidency, 11,000 people were tortured or murdered by his henchmen. It was during this same period that both Fabiola and Big Freddie began to believe that they were under surveillance by the state or those aligned with the right-wing Balaguer administration. Big Freddie told me a story about a time he was visiting Fabiola that made him suspect that they were under surveillance.
And when I was visiting her, I saw a guy at the corner kind of looking back to where she was living, and I was there. So either I become paranoid or something, we thought that the guy was, you know, looking to us there. So, but I left. I remember I took a cab later on, and I went home. And I spoke to a friend of mine about that. And later on, they sent a note to his mother, letting her know that he shouldn't be associating with me because I was associating with somebody, with Fabiola. To me, it was somebody from the right wing. They think that's what I feel, was a threat that I was getting associated with somebody who attend to the state security.
Fabiola was considered a threat to the status quo.
Listen, during that time, they was killing a lot of people. I was scared. The mother of my friend was scared.
What about Fabiola?
She maybe was concerned.
Concerned? What exactly were her nerves made of? She may not have been scared, but Big Freddy and his parents were downright terrified. Following that episode, they wanted to send him to a small town away from the capital to hide out.
I didn't want to go to a little town. They want to send me to hide out there. So we stayed home. So my parents decided, I think we had to get out of the country. So a group of friends of mine got together. Some of them said, no, don't do that. Don't worry about it. But someone said, yeah, if you had to go, you had to go. So I was coming over here only for 1 year and then come back after the whole thing passed. So that came to avoid whatever persecution could happen.
Fabiola and Big Freddy decided it was time to leave temporarily for New York City. In December 1970, Big Freddy came on a student visa, which he had earlier obtained as part of a Catholic student group. Fabiola arrived 6 months later using the passport of her sister who had a tourist visa. They bore a striking resemblance to each other, which allowed Fabiola to enter the U.S. undetected. In April 1972, they welcomed the birth of my partner Fred once. Then they settled in the Bronx, but were compelled to move to Brooklyn after Fabiola was recognized by a fellow student at Hostos Community College. This was problematic because besides being here on an undocumented status, she had been part of a leftist movement that was still being harshly persecuted in her home country. In 1975, they enrolled at Pratt University in Brooklyn as engineering students. Life was challenging for the young parents. Big Freddy, in retrospect, seemed proud that despite the challenges at the predominantly white institution, they persevered in those early days.
Because we did that, we all the difficulty that somebody could have. Remember, we didn't master the language. We didn't have the legal support to be doing that. And I also remember that talking about the language, that one time, when I was taking, I don't know if it was American history or literacy, that I told the teacher, I can't understand this. I don't know how to answer that. And the teacher told me, get out of the classroom if you don't know English. So I said, I'm going to stay here. I failed the course, but why do I have to get out?
The lack of legal support Big Freddy mentions is the fact that both he and Fabiola were undocumented at the time. Eventually, with a desire to adjust their status to a legal one, they enlisted the help of a lawyer. He advised them to apply for permanent residency as parents of a U.S. citizen, young Fred once. This was one of the paths to permanent residency at that time. He insisted that they apply at the U.S. consulate in Mexico or Canada. In those countries, the U.S. consulate had no jurisdiction to deport them to the Dominican Republic, and if rejected, they would be able to return to the States. He cautioned that if they applied in the Dominican Republic and failed to get approval, they would not be able to get back to New York. Fabiola balked at that advice. Her son Guido had been living for the last 7 years with family, and so she insisted that they go to the Dominican Republic to apply for their green cards, including for Guido, who also needed one. At the consulate, the wait was long.
We noted that we wait and wait and wait and wait. And everybody left the console, and only Chi and I. So here came the guy, and he's, I was with Guido there with his brother, because he also needed to get a paper. He and that child, they, you could visit them, they could get the resident, but Chi stayed here, because Chi attended to the security of the United States.
She threatened the security of the United States? Uh-oh, the lawyer was right. Fabiola was stuck. Stay tuned for what happened next in part 2 of Excursions, Dominican Republic Edition.